saw you look quite so pretty before. Never saw you dress quite so handsome, what's more. I could hardly wait to keep our days this lovely Easter morning. And my heart beat fast as I came through the door. For in your Easter bonnet, with all the frills upon it, you'll be the grandest fellow in the Easter. In the Easter parade on the Avenue, Fifth Avenue, the photographers will snap us, and you'll find that you're in the rotogravure. Oh, I could write a sonnet about your Easter bonnet. Guy I'm taking to the Easter parade.
On the Avenue, Fifth Avenue, the photographers will snap us, and you'll find that you're in the rotogravure.
It's Sunday afternoon, and time once again for Wordplay. I'm your host, Jeff Davis. As you might gather from that opening song, it is indeed Easter. And in the spirit of such comings and goings, today we're going to celebrate the work of Jonathan Williams, who left this mortal plane just over a year ago. Today we'll listen to a reading that Jonathan gave in England in 1981, about the time his selection, Get Hot or Get Out, was published by London's Scarecrow Press. All of Jonathan's books are selected poems and contain writing not to be found anywhere else. Get Hot or Get Out, for instance, contains a fine sequence of poems grounded in the work of American composer Charles Ives. Jonathan includes some of that series in this reading. A little later, we'll also hear an interview with Jonathan from 2003. Now here's Jonathan Williams reading in 1981.
What I proposed was two poems from two sequences, which I'll tell you about. But first, just to declare kind of the place I come from and the place in North Carolina, and then at the very end, the place I live in here, since I like to listen to a kind of rustic sound more than a city sound, which makes me a little unusual. B. Hensley hammers an iron chinkapin leaf on his anvil near Spruce Pine, North Carolina, and he cogitates on the nature of two beauty spots. In the Linville Gorge, I know this place. Now it's a rock wall. You look up, it's covered in punctatum all the way to heaven. That's a sight. Up on Smoky, you wheeze up at daybust and see the first light in the tops of the tulip trees. Now, boys, that just naturally grinds and polishes the soul. Makes it normal again. I mean, it's really pretty. This is a thing called A Celestial Centennial Reverie for Charles Edward Ives. Lou Harrison, the composer, says about Charles Ives, he's the man who found American music in the ground. where it had always been and no one knew it. Ives was neglected until his 70s. He wrote the, let's see if I can tell you precisely, he wrote the Concord Sonata about 1905, I suppose, and it was really not until the 40s that anyone ever tried to play it well, and he had a kind of a breakdown. He was an insurance executive as well as our greatest composer, and he had a breakdown of some sort. A nervous thing happened when he was about 40, and he came down to North Carolina, to Asheville, where I was born, and went to a remarkable resort there called the Grove Park Inn, where Bela Bartok, oddly enough, years later, came and wrote his last piece. Well, Ives wrote an essay book called Essays Before a Sonata to tell people, you know, what this music was about, and I found it interesting to read the sonata and read the essays and write something of my own using just occasional words that I found in the prose text. So it's totally reorganized, but as with Ives, interestingly enough, he never seems to have written a tune that was his own. Always used other people's tunes, the ones he found in the ground. So, Essays Before a Sonata, and these are out of the prologue, and I'm going to read at random. I've checked off tonight the way I like to read it across the text in the Ivesian manner. Can a tune literally represent a stone wall with vines on it or even nothing on it? Those meadows and the woods, so pure and bright a light as would have waked the dead, brought me there, brought you. A feeling that all is left unsaid. They seem to stand about as they did. They use the same words. They go on. Modernism is an anachronism and is as futile as calling today's sunset modern. He hacks his way up and down. He makes us feel that we are free to do so, seeing the signpost Erebus strong enough to go the other way. Originality works down through the crust toward the first fire when 1,000 wrought like one. Thoughts surge to his mind. He fills heavens with them, crowds them in, seldom arranges them, along the ground first. Mud may be a form of sincerity. Daybreak cannot be explained at noon. Inspiration all gone up in sounds. A home run at evening. The intellect is never a hole. It is where the soul finds things. The rivers in thought stream through us. Somewhere between jowl and soul, beguiling a few sensual mortals. Uncovers a, quote, deformed foot, unquote, gives it a name. Somehow like to mix it up with sin. Spare nothing, want all material, convert all impediments into instruments, be hoarse as earth beat, sea beat, heartbeat, the time to which the sun rolls, and the globule of blood, and the sap of the trees. A gospel hymn of simple devotion comes out to him through autumn fields of sumac and aster, wild native Orpheus, from what obscurity? The hunger of a lifetime, sometimes by one meal. This movement's called Hawthorne. His intellectual masks would weave his spell over us. Unlike something I had heard of Ravel, whose music is of a kind I cannot stand. Pleasing enough if you want to be pleased. Secrets of which he wonders at. The less guilty elves of the conquered elms play around his pages. Our music is something to do with the old hymn tune that haunts the church and sings only to those in the churchyard to protect them from secular noises, or something to do with a concert at the Stamford camp meeting, or something to do with a Concord he-nymph, not something that happens, but the way something happens, or about something that never will happen, or something else that is not. Movement, the Alcotts, always doing something within. Under the Concord sky, there sits the little old spinet piano Sophia Thoreau gave to the Alcott children, on which Beth played at the Fifth Symphony. A common interest in common things and common men, a tune the Concord bards are ever playing, while they pound away at the immensities with a Beethoven-like sublimity. Not much besides the memory of that house under the elms, in this world, in the next. Movement, Thoreau. Not because he played the flute, but because he... Miles of space intervene between men, measure the solitude. Grass from Iceland could be found in Concord, in which an ode to mourning might be sung. Let nature put him under her microscope, then hold her under his. Inside work, out of doors, and time from demands of time. 40,000 souls at a ball game rubbing elbows don't bring men's minds closer together, neither is their safety in stupidity alone. This man's intimacy with God, as if he had a monopoly on the subject, not that the ship was sinking, but that he was. Someone asked Thoreau if he found it lonely there. Only by your help, he said. They remind us that he died of consumption, but forget that he lived with consumption. These people who will die literally and with the pedal loud. Follow him some spring morning to Baker Farm. Pine groves, so soft and green and shady, druids would forsake their oaks to worship in them. Many in Concord knew that within their village there was a tree of wondrous growth, the shadow of which, alas, the only part they were allowed to touch. You know your Thoreau, but not my Thoreau. One low day, the sun had gone down, long, long before sunset. You know him not unless you love him. He knows now he must let nature flow through him, and slowly, in reverie amidst goldenrod, sand cherry and sumac, he grew in those seasons like corn in the night, better than any works of the hand. It was morning, and lo, now it is evening, and nothing memorable accomplished. Darker, the poet's flute is heard out over the pond. Epilogue. And to the rest of our friends, a series of unpleasant sounds. A man remembers his father, just returned from a performance of Siegfried, ashamed of enjoying the music as he did. The love was make-believe, the passion all make-believe, as was the dragon. Former beauty and nobility were not there, and in their place stood irritating intervals of descending fourths and fifths. Something in us has made us flow past him, and not he past us. We prefer to go around in a circle than around in a parallelepipedon. We prefer Whittier to Baudelaire, a healthy to a rotten apple. We like the beautiful. We are glad the beautiful is not ugly. Having unsettled what beauty is, we go on. What you are, talk so loud, I cannot hear what you say. If Debussy had hoed corn or sold newspapers for a living, he might have gained a deeper vitality to sing at night and of a Sunday. Debussy, that city man who comes out for a Sunday in the country. The waiter brings the only fresh egg he has, but the man at breakfast sends it back because it doesn't fit his egg cup. My God, what has sound got to do with music? Why can't music go out in the same way it comes in to a man without having to crawl over a fence of sounds, thoraxes, catguts, wire, wood, and brass? Isn't it the composer's fault that a man has only 10 fingers? The country has not been waiting for anybody. To see the sunrise, a man has to but get up early. Ragtime has its uses, as the cruet on the boarding house table has. But to plant a whole farm with sunflowers, to put a sunflower into every bouquet, would be calling nature something worse than a politician. Better than bad music is no music. Better to go to the plate and strike out than to hold the bench down, than let the ears lie back in an easy chair. Beethoven had to pull the ear hard and in the same place several times, for the 1790 ear was tougher than the 1890 ear. If nature is not enthusiastic about explanation, why should Tchaikovsky be?
2003, Hillsborough poet Jeffrey Beam, who is a second-generation jargonaut, made the trek to Scaly Mountain to interview Jonathan for Rain Taxi magazine. Jeffrey didn't have radio in mind when he recorded. He just needed something audible that he could transcribe, so he used a small cassette recorder. I've cleaned up the tape hiss as much as I could without totally distorting the voices, but if it sounds a little bit unnatural, that's why. Here's Jeffrey Beam talking with Jonathan Williams in 2003.
I think one of the most moving tributes and revealing moments in Blackbird Dust is your tribute to John Davis, your teacher at St. Albans, in which you also mention Ruge?
Ferdinand Ruge.
Ruge.
It's a German name.
And Stambaugh. Especially your story of Stambaugh taking you to the Phillips Gallery to stand in front of Redon and Ryder. You burst into merriment and then sobered up. You realized that they were celebrating human difference. So why does it matter that human difference be celebrated?
Well, at the age of 12, I guess it was, to be put in front of a Odilon Redon painting is tough. It's a world that I knew nothing about. It's mystical, strange. I think it's actually, the painting is like Girl with Flowers. And the girl looks like something out of James Thurber, and the flowers are quite strange. I'd never seen anything like that. It seemed completely inept. It's like the first time I heard Bruckner. I thought, God, this guy's such a dummy. You know, how can he go on after introducing, I think, the Seventh Symphony was the one I heard first, and I couldn't figure that out at all. You know, when you're confronted with people who are so different from oneself, of course, that's the wonder of life. But at an age like 12, you can't expect too much. I was able to digest the writer pretty easily. It's called Moonlit Cove. It's a kind of melancholic night scene that he was so great at. I think he's really the greatest painter of the 19th century, and Aikens is maybe second or third. But your question is one that puzzles me. I don't know. Let's go on a little further.
I know the two paintings because I've seen them myself, and I can see how a 12-year-old would be able to respond immediately to the writer simply because there's this, it's just right there in front of you, the darkness, the moonlight.
The boat.
Everything is just, there's some energy there that a 12-year-old would understand.
Yeah.
And the Redon is really sort of the opposite extreme. That all this light and color and still a mist in a way, but a less accessible simply because it's not the real world, it's another world. Was there something that Stambaugh said to you that helped you make a connection between the two? So that,
well, he told
now
me,
these many years later, you would connect the two?
When he saw my laughing distress, he told me to hush up. Be polite, you're Mr. Duncan Phillips' home. But I haven't had a reaction to too many paintings. So looking back, I really kind of wondered. But as I say, I've never seen anything like that, ever.
So Stambaugh, in a way, offered that lesson that you've mentioned a number of times in different ways, and that is just to be quiet and take it in.
Take it in. He was, as I say, he was a remarkably kind and a very astute man, very quiet, very, he enjoyed teaching at a prep school. He hardly ever entered his pictures in competitions. He wasn't trying to get ahead. He stayed at St. Albans, I think, perhaps 30 years. He came from up on the Pennsylvania-New York border,
or there's some hills, and he painted wonderfully. His landscapes are fine, but they're not ambitious. You know, they're modest, as he was. Remember, I think he's one of the most impressive people on me. He dressed better than anybody I'd ever seen. He had terrific tweed jackets and good shirts and good ties. You know. He was a very natty individual.
Well, so these early guys taught you your style, fashion style sense, too.
Yeah, of course, St. Albans had a very conservative dress. You had to wear, gray flannels and blazers, blue blazers, white shirts, and you had your choice of ties. But that's what I grew up with, and I must say, I find nothing wrong with it. I like to do it still. Even in the country, I don't put on the ties, but I try to wear decent clothes.
Do you think that's why, this morning you mentioned that someone had said of you not too long ago that you were only gay below the waist?
Below the waist? Below the waistcoat?
That somehow the tie and everything else confuses people. They think you're straight.
Oh, yeah. I've had that happen. I went into the Cedar Tavern one day in about 1957 or whatever, and that's where all the Black Mountain people who lived in New York hung out. And I'd been out trying to sell our Zukovsky book and our Denise Levertov book, and I think maybe the Test of Poetry. I was going around to places like Scribner's, booksellers, and some of the bookshops uptown, Fifth Avenue, Madison Avenue. And I was tired, and I was carrying this heavy briefcase. And I was wearing, for the purpose that I was set out to do, I was wearing a brown worsted suit and a tie. And I walked into Cedars, and back in the back was of all people, Gregory Corso. And I'd never met him. He had never met me. But before he shook hands, he said, "Why are you wearing those damn clothes?" Well, that was all I needed to hear from him. So I went back to the bar and let them at it. I don't know who was there, three or four guys. So clothes can be misleading. I mean, Jack Spicer, who was as gay as three grapes, when Halloween time came in San Francisco, there was a gay bar, one of the few in town, I think, in those days. I'm talking about 1954. I had not met Spicer until somebody was with me and said, "Let's go into the Black Cat. It's next to the police station, interestingly enough." I said, "How will I recognize Jack?" He said, "He'll be wearing the business suit." Halloween. He'll be wearing the business suit. So I liked that. And, I think people have a right to dress the way they want to.
Well, I think of your photograph of Charles Olson at Black Mountain where he doesn't have a shirt on. And when you were at Black Mountain, did you continue to dress and... had you already developed this formal way of dressing, and while you were there, did you stand out as someone who was somewhat less relaxed in the way they presented themselves visually to the world?
Well, I was the only person at Black Mountain who, been to prep school and gone to Princeton and spent time in New York and all that. I mean, no, I didn't dress any differently than anybody else did, I don't think, at Black Mountain. Certainly not the faculty. I mean, Lou Harrison was rather dressy, but nobody else. But Lou had, San Francisco, New York background. But no, I don't think one wanted to stand out particularly at Black Mountain. I think I did maybe try to, whenever we'd go into Asheville or into Black Mountain town, they were so looking at Black Mountain College people as, freaks, sideshow attractions, gorillas, and so I dressed casually, but that's all.
But like a good Southern boy.
Yeah.
Presentable.
Presentable, absolutely. Always be presentable.
Well, it's one of the things I think that stands out in the photographs in Palpable Elysium is that you capture these folks in their costume, in the way that they are the most real. How did you approach all of these folks to do these photographs? I mean, was it just something everyone knew that you did, or did you set out and to go to Rex Roth one day and say, "Today I want to take your photograph, and this is what we're going to do"?
I think he probably knew I took pictures. I've taken black and white pictures. But I think that color picture is the best picture of him I ever got. And
so you just carried your camera around with you all the time, or
yeah,
other days?
Yeah, camera bag, and I photographed him quite a lot, but I think that's the best one. Color is really nice, and in its current form, in its digitized form, it's wonderful. It looks better than it ever did. I guess that photograph of Merton, you know, he's outside of his little hermitage and seated at a kind of little metal chair, and he's wearing a dungaree jacket. I somehow didn't expect that, because most of the monks at the abbey, full habit, I guess you might say.
Right.
And he wasn't. He was allowed to dress it in this other way.
How long had you known him when that photograph was taken?
Maybe a year or two. I think I met him about 1964.
But you visited pretty regularly.
Yeah, a couple times a year. And I guess through about 67, maybe. I think it was maybe 68 when he was on that trip in the Orient, when he died through this crazy electrical system in his hotel.
How did you become aware of Thomas Merton's work?
Well, I've read some, and knowing James Laughlin at New Directions, he would send me books of Merton's. It was just like that.
But it was Davenport who first took you there, is that right? Or
No,
it was Guy Mendez?
I think I first went there on my own. And then at some point, we arranged a picnic with Merton. And I introduced him to Guy Davenport, and I introduced him to Guy Mendes and Meteor, except that those three guys. We just all went down
and
had a picnic.
Meteor took some photographs at Merton, didn't he?
He took a lot. As a matter of fact, there's a book collecting the pictures. It's over there. I can't see if you can.
I'll look and see.
See if you can spot it.
Is Guy Mendes' book?
It's a Meteor.
It's a Meteor book. Okay.
It's just in there somewhere.
There's, and this relates too, I think, to something you said this morning about how you went to Merton and then you took Mendez and Davenport, so all of a sudden there's this conversation going. And you mentioned this morning that during breakfast that Edward Dahlberg had once said to you that literature was the way we ripen ourselves by
conversation.
And that seems to me very much present in both A Palpable Elysium and in Blackbird Dust, that one of the wonderful things about both the photographs and how you write about them and the essays about the people and places in Blackbird Dust is that it's not just you being a documentarian. You're not just reporting. You're not just a journalist, but you're conversing with those people or those places, and you hear the conversation of what you've written, But you also hear it in the photographs. And I think that's a very hard thing to do. How do you think that happens?
Well, as you know, a lot of my poetry is quote, found, unquote. And that's, I think, because I think I'm quite a good listener. And I'm willing to, you know, lay back and listen. And I think it's something to do with some of living in the country. And I mean, this place, Skywinding Farm, I mean, there are times when Tom Meyer and I will only see somebody from the outside world once or twice a week. And we've known each other so long, but we don't talk as much as we might. Enough, but, you know, it's not what we're particularly involved with. So I like to listen, and I like to find things. So if you listen carefully, you do find things. I do all the time. I mean, it's, and, you know, the early book, Blues and Roots, which was done kind of in the course of walking a big piece of the Appalachian Trail, I listened to mountain people, you know, for 1,000 miles. I really heard some good stuff. And I left it pretty much as I heard it. I didn't have to do anything except, you know,
right,
organize a little bit, crystallize it, you know. And, I mean, I think that's the thing I love about found material is that you make it up. You make it into something.
Well, it's a bit like collage, you know.
If you
do,
if you don't, you know,
you haven't heard it.
People can hear it if you put it on the page right, and you get the spaces and the silences and so on.
Well, I think that's so true of the Irwin Bartram's tree poems, that it's the way you've put them on the page that allows the reader to hear them exactly as you heard them. Which is very hard to do, because what most writers want to do, and certainly journalists want to do, is to elaborate and editorialize and add to and try to explain how this person sounded or something, and you don't do that. And there's a great lesson, I think, in that for all of us.
Yeah, I mean, well, it's the old Einstein saying, you know, keep things as simple as they are, but not simpler.
Do you think this is partly a Southern trait? Of course, people think of Southern writers as talkers, as storytellers, but it seems to me that there's a great... The other part of that is that there's a great deal of listening that goes on in Southern culture.
Well, in the mountains, at least. I don't know, down in the Piedmont, seems like everybody's out there on the front porch jabbering, you know, and whole novels are based on what they talk about on the front porch. I do get a little tired of that.
Do you think it's something to do with the mountain landscape that allows that space for listening in?
Yeah, I mean, people are very reticent up here. I mean, once you get to know them, like old Uncle Liv Owens, who lived across the road, he was the best mountain talker I ever found. I mean, he was in a class by himself. And this is going back 50 years. But anytime you get with him, he'd just say the most extraordinary things. And I'd run home and write them down as fast as I could, so I, you know, keep them pretty well accurate. I loved his language. He had some of the best language of anybody I've ever heard. And he didn't know how to read or write.
It's one of the great...
He sure knew how to talk. That's the one thing he could do.
It's one of the great evils of television and other media, I think, is that it's flattened out the creativity of just natural language. You know, what comes out. I mean, you've done the same thing with folks in North Western England,
yeah,
where you hear a language that hasn't been obliterated yet by the media.
Well, that's it. I mean, you know, you're dealing with people who talk funny, as far as the people down in London are concerned. They don't know, you know, it's a class thing, a lot of it is in England. If you don't sound as though you went to Cambridge and Oxford, you know, it's demeaning. And all the BBC announcers all talk to speak in a certain way. Not quite as much as it used to be. I mean, there'll be the odd Scotsman on there telling you about the weather, which is rather refreshing, really. But you sort of take, about everything I do, it's kind of, I'm dealing with one or two people, I'm getting something from them, and then I'm putting it on paper, hoping that a couple of people will respond to it. It's a very intimate thing.
Little Monk there. And now we'll throw a change-up pitch. Here's a track by British entertainer, singer, comedian, photographer, filmmaker, Mike Harding. You can see that he and Jonathan had many interests in common, so it's not surprising that they were friends. Here's his fabulously funny Manuel.
Manuel worked in a chippy in Salford. Manuel made the fat fly till a loose living lady called Gladly Gladys, and Manuel cast a glad eye. Manuel took Gladys to the Ritz on a Friday, led her on to the floor, and as they danced, as they romanced, the people all started to roar. Cause Manuel danced the samba with no trousers on. And the people shouted, Ole muchos cojon. Manuel danced the samba with no trousers on. Yip, 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 yip. And the people shouted, Ole muchos cojon. Manuel's real name was Eric Winterbottom. Till he went on a package tour to Spain. After he caught a bucket in Ibiza, he went home and had his name changed. Latin, they entranced him, this pimply Salford youth. He called his girlfriend Gladys, one eater, cause she only had one tooth. Manuel danced, the samba with no trousers on. Yip, yip, dip your bread. People shouted, Ole muchos cojon, hasta la vista, okey la pokey. Manuel danced, the samba with no trousers on. And the people shouted, Ole muchos cojon. No! Manuel. Toro! Manuel met Gladys south of the border. It was down Birmingham way. She played the maracas and chewed tobacco in a sleazy Walsall cafe. The moment he saw her, he fell for her. He knew where his heart lay. Her flying maracas made his eyes water. As he breathlessly whispered, "Ole, Manuel, dance December with no trousers on." People shouted, "Ole, Montos, go on." Manuel danced December with no trousers on. He tipped your bread. And the people shouted, "Ole, Montos, go on." Oh, Manuel and Gladys traveled the country, giving exhibition dances. December, the rumba, the paso doble, and other things. Manuel, he danced with no pants. Till in a draft, he danced all in Dunfermline. Someone left a door open wide. An icy cold blast caught Manuel as he spun past. 3 days later, he died. Gladys, she pined for her Manuela, threw herself under a box. So they took her, in a box they stuck her, with the minimum of fuss, sheer portrait. Still they say down Salford way, at night when the gas light flickers. Manuel he dances without no pants, and Gladys she dances also. And the people shouted, "Ole, Montos, go on." What you'll do for a crust, it's amazing. Manuel danced, December with no trousers on. Tip your bread, okey bun. And the people shouted, "Ole, Montos, go on."
Here's the second selection of poems from Jonathan's 1981 reading, and he throws a change up, too.
These are called the 52 Clara Hughes of Clara Hughes. And I didn't find out about Clara Hughes officially till this summer when Gavin Ewart wrote a piece for something like The Listener. And I suddenly found myself for 2 weeks doing nothing but writing these idiotic little poems. You know how they work. They're invented by a man called Edmund Clara Hugh Bentley, E.C. Bentley, who wrote a play that's well known called, or a novel called Trent's Last Case. And he was 16 and at St. Paul's School when he was struck by divine inspiration and wrote, "The digestion of Milton was unequal to Stilton. He was only feeling so-so when he wrote Il Penseroso." So, a master at work. It's very difficult to write them that well. "Kennst du das Land? John Addington Symonds was very fond of lemons, plucked by Venetian gondoliers, graced with jolly great big ears." From a biography by Humphrey Carpenter, W.H. Auden, oughtn't pee in the sink, that's queer as pink ink. "Deliverance, never read James Dickey when the weather's hot and icky. The time for Dickey Duncan's when defrost is on de punkin." In the raw bar, Colchester, said Morgan Forster, over some oysters, "Only canet a cut." Near Whinny Haw, climbing Furbank Fell, Ronald Furbank fell about laughing at two heifers fucking. "The more descant and the less real cant, the better blues." Basil Bunting had them grunting, darkish R's and slouchy vowels from Rothy Valley madrigals. The artist, J. Atkinson Grimshaw, rode about Leeds in a rickshaw at night in order to observe industrial moonlight. The Summer Smoking Room, Cardiff. From infancy, Billy Burgess was given to very bizarre French Gothic urges. And the castles he designed for the third Marquess of Bute are quite a hoot. Non confundar. Herr Dr. Professor Anton Bruckner, for all his glory, had a brain like an overturned lorry. He said Brahms couldn't jubilate. Addlepate. Jeffrey Grigson, over the long seasons, recurs like the ineluctable onion in one's digestion. The Feast. Stevie Smith invited death to live with her and eat verdure. Or however you say that. Verdure? I don't know how to say that word. V-E-R-D-U-R-E. I never use that word. Anyway, I think it's a little different than verdure. Verdure? Verdure? I don't know how the hell you say that. The Baron. Both bodacious and humongous was large Charles Mingus. On both mouth and bass, he played his ass. Thrones. Mombi the Witch had an itch to be a girl goddess like Robert Duncan in his Eleusinian pearl headdress. And how do you say, is it Brasnose? Brasnose? How do you say that college? You know. Brasnose. I thought it might be like, you know, up north they say Bruns or something. Late afternoon, Shea, Brasnose College. Walter Pater always served them pate. Jim liked it flambé, burning with a Jim-like flame. Rivendell. Why did not Professor J.R.R. Tolkien ever really come clean about the Scientologists in cupboards in the house of L. Ron Hubbard? Sunt lacrimae rerum. The truth is, William Blake is hard to take for those of us with earthy ears and ears the size of tiny deers. May. The late Miss West lounges now amidst the blessed. Elysian men display their inches and kneel on special jock-sized benches. The Outsider. The eldritch, supercosmic Howard Phillips Lovecraft was thought a bit daft by Tassa Thaga and Shub Nagurath, as well as by Great Aunt Ruth. Le Matin dans la Rue de Fleurieu, number 27. Gertrude Stein, a rose at nine, and a rose and a rose and a rose. The Hot Corner in the Bronx, 1903. Ron Kitai, rhymes with bonsai, is the only Chagrin Falls humanist who remembers who Piano Legs Hickman ist. At the Wheel, Edmund Clarihue Bentley wrote Clarihue's Couchant in a Bentley. Anything more formless made him feel gormless. Finis, Clarihue's, the author of these Clarihue's, wrote them strictly to chase the blues. Gee, I think they're neat, said her illiterate girlfriend, Pete.
Jonathan switched tones again to close his 1981 reading and finished with a poem for his friend, the English poet Basil Bunting.
One more local. In honor of our friend Mr. Bunting, my Quaker atheist friend who has come to Brig Flat's meeting house since 1912, smokes and looks out over the Rothy River to Holme Fell. What do you do anything for? You do it for what the medievals would call something like the glory of God. Doing it for money, that doesn't do it. Doing it for vanity, that doesn't do it. Doing it to justify a disorderly life, that doesn't do it. Look at Brig Flat's meeting. It represents the best that the people were able to do. They didn't do it for gain. In fact, they must have taken a loss. Whether it is a stone next to a stone or a word next to a word, it is the glory, the simple craft of it. And money and sex aren't worth bugger all. Not bugger all. Solid, common, vulgar words. The ones you can touch. The ones that yield. And a respect for the music. And what else can you tell them? Thank you.
And that's Wordplay for this week. We've been listening today to Jonathan Williams. I hope you've enjoyed it. Special thanks to Thorns Craven, longtime treasurer of the Jargon Society, for the tapes of Jonathan's reading and of many of today's musical selections. And big thanks too to Jeffrey Beam for the recording of his Rain Taxi interview. Tune in again next week when we'll once again be bringing poetry to the airwaves and to the ether. Have a great week.